Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. This is Tell Me About It with Scroobius Pip and Stuart Whiffin. I'm Scroobius Pip and I'm sat opposite Mr.
Stu Whiffin. You call me Stuart. Why did you call me Stuart?
I've got you written down there as Stuart Whiffin for some reason.
Take the art out of it.
Okay. You do that.
There we go.
You sure take the art out of these things.
Well, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm excited to get episode 3 out. I mean, episode 2, and if you're new to this as well, and you've just jumped in at episode 3, welcome to the party. You're a little bit late, but you're still welcome in. Take your shoes off at the door, please, but do come in. But when you get to the end of episode 3, I would highly recommend that you go and check out episodes 1 and 2. And what have they been?
They have been School Days and Dan Lesac.
Lovely.
So two fruitful topics, but so is this week's one, which is playing live, because there's a lot to talk about. There's been some varied experiences, some mad and amazing moments, but also it's occurred to me 3 episodes in, I mean, we should get a little plug in for our other podcasts. Obviously I've got Distraction Pieces, but it's just interviews and that with loads of really cool people.
Who, like?
Have you heard of Stephen Fry?
Oh, yeah.
You familiar with Mary J. Blige?
Yep.
Louis Theroux, ring any bells?
See the dancer that was on Pineapple Dance Studios.
That's the one. Yeah. Had a few people on, but you've got Hardcore Listing with Chris Glasson, where a lot of people will know you from already, which is top fives about anything and everything. And you've had some amazing guests on there, but you also do a lot of amazing episodes of just the two of you. And you've got Off the Beaten Track, which is your music podcast, which, on versions of it, kind of has elements of talking about live and talking about being at gigs and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, we do sort of some little standalone episodes sometimes. If I've had a guest that, you know, really enjoyed the experience and wants to come back on, sometimes I'll get them back on and we'll talk about, obviously if they're a musician, talking about playing live, talking about first gigs and things like that. So you've been kind enough to come on and do that as well. And go check out Distraction Pieces, Hardcore Listing, and Off the Beaten Track. I could list another 35 podcasts that I do, but we're not here for them.
Stu's got a lot of podcasts. But yeah, we're here for another one. And should let you know, this is series 1. It's a 5-part series. So we're approaching the halfway mark.
Yeah.
Midway through this conversation, it'll be the halfway mark. Mm. And then when we pop up at the end for the outro, we're over halfway through the series.
That's happened quickly.
Let's go. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? But let's jump into it. But we're going to, as I said, episodes 4 and 5 are still to come. Episode 4 is about divorce, and episode 5 is about acting. Mm. So, yeah, it was important, I think, when we were planning the topics, to get a good mixture of just personal life stories, personal life topics, and career stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, onto the career stuff. We're playing live. Let's hear all of my embarrassing moments, I guess.
Yes, please. What was the first concert you saw, or first live experience you saw, and can you remember how that made you feel?
So we would have gone to some of the, like, the, you know, when Capital FM used to do gigs or festivals. They used to do festivals of just pop acts.
Yeah, Radio 1 used to do the Radio 1 Roadshow.
Yeah, it was like that, but there was a Capital version as well, I think. And I remember going to one or two of them, and it'd be literally people coming out to do their one
hit.
Pop hit. I'm trying to think of what some of them were. I've got one really clear in my head, but I can clearly think of the vibe of it and the visual, but I can't place it. So it was kind of the Charles and Eddie. Would I Lie to You? Was that Charles and Eddie?
Yeah, what a tune.
Yeah, I remember seeing that live as a kid. I remember my brother had tickets. My brother and my mum had tickets to go and see Michael Jackson.
Wow.
I think they went and I think they saw him, but maybe it was it was cancelled and then rescheduled. Mm. So I was too young. But first proper live gig. So I was 13 or 14 like when I started going to gigs, and gigs were everything. As we've discussed in previous episodes, yeah. I never had girlfriends. I never had relationships, but I had gigs. And I remember the same week I went to see the Rolling Stones on the Voodoo Lounge Tour and Offspring on the Smash Tour. So Stones at Wembley, Offspring at Brixton. Such different gigs, but such good gigs. And yeah, that was it. I'd be going to gigs every weekend or two. Me, Mark Irvine and Martin Birmingham. Then Daniel Lusi had come along. And it was just, yeah, gigs were everything. I loved it. I loved crowd surfing, stage diving, everything, just getting involved. All these little punk gigs. And again, you can look back at your Green Days and your Offsprings and turn your nose up a bit. But what a period that was. If you were that age, and how exciting that was with all of those bands, your Rancids, all that. But then all the California bands and stuff that came off the back of that, all your ska bands that were touring, the UK bands who would support everyone. Just going to gigs was just, yeah, it was absolutely everything. I remember at about the age of 13, going along with my dad to pick my brother up from a Smashing Pumpkins gig and seeing it all from the outside and being like, I want to be old enough to be to be going into that. And then I remember Ian had tickets for that last Nirvana tour that never happened. Mm-hmm. And I remember it being, again, not being a rich family, it being... You can have a refund. You've just got to send your ticket back, and it being that battle of, do we want our 12 quid or do we want to keep the ticket of what would have been the last ever Nirvana tour?
Yeah.
So I remember the feeling of it coming from voyeuristically.
Yeah.
Watching my brother go to gigs and be involved in gigs and not being there.
Yeah.
And local gigs, mate.
Yeah.
Serious problem at the Grays. Civic on an all-dayer where my mate Andy's band Big Red were opening.
Yeah.
Things like that were probably, I guess, yeah, early, because it's before I was at college. Yep. So it would have been early days of going to gigs.
Yeah.
Loved all of it, mate.
Yeah.
I loved all of it. It was so exciting, regardless of the quality.
Did you ever... Hang on. That's more directed at me, not the Smashing Pumpkins,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So... All of them gigs that you mentioned, there's a lot of energy involved in all of them shows.
Yeah.
And as a teen, like, that's what you want, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
You don't want to be sitting down watching Leonard Cohen. You want to be losing your mind at a Green Day gig, don't you?
Which 100%.
Which is where it's at. But, you know, seeing all that energy coming off the stage and obviously the crowds always throw it back. Did you ever have any desire at that point to want to perform on a stage?
Mm-hmm. That's why I got like a guitar and... Barely learned it. Had lessons off Joe Hymus.
Yeah.
Basildon legend, Joe Hymus, absolute legend of the Towngate.
Yeah.
Putting on events.
And Hayseed Dixie now.
Hayseed Dixie, yeah. Mm. Had guitar lessons. I wanted to be in a band. Me and my mate Rick started a band called Lardass. We had various different lead singers. Tom was a lead singer at some point. I was a lead singer. Andy was lead singer. We never wrote any songs or did anything. We were part responsible for the Lunar Club closing down because, again, I'd read loads of punk books and I'd read Malcolm McLaren, so it's all about marketing. Mm-hmm. So I got us booked at, what was the one in Southend at the end? The Curzon. Is it the Curzon?
No, you had the Esplanade, you had Chinnery's.
Wasn't either of them.
And you had Club Riga.
Maybe
Club there was Riga. The Curzel.
Yeah, the Curzel. That's they had some kind of live gigs in the Curzel. So I got Lardass booked for a gig there, and I got the Southend Echo or whatever where they had the list in, and it said this band, and supported by the appallingly monikered Lardass. Still got that cut out somewhere. And we got booked at the Lunar Club to support someone associated with you. So it was, I reckon it was after, what was the band you were in that did really good with the twins?
Lilo.
After Lilo, someone from Lilo had their next band and it was going to be the next thing.
Right.
I'm sure they did. And we were booked to support them, but obviously we didn't really exist.
Yeah.
So we never turned up.
That band was the Somethings.
The Somethings, that's it.
That was the rest of the Serious Problem, not Lilo.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah. So that gig happened and no one turned up. One of the bands didn't even turn up. And they said, right, we're calling it a day on the Lunar Club. And that was just me going, market it, market it, market it. We're getting our name in magazines.
Yeah.
We didn't have any songs.
Yeah.
Me and Rick would meet up and play fun-loving criminal songs, Green Day songs, all sorts of stuff in my garage. But we hadn't written anything, hadn't done anything. But I was like, Lard Arse is a good name.
Yeah.
In that era of punk bands, it was a good name. It stood out.
Name.
But that's all we had. So yeah, there was that. And there was, again, as we touched upon in another episode, there was many other fictional bands.
Yeah.
Pretending I'm in a band called Anti-Penultimate.
Yeah.
But then the first band I was properly in was a covers band. And that gave me my first experiences on stage. So I was working at HMV. So this will be.
Why do I not know this?
This will be 2002 kind of era. And me and a few of the others of the HMV lot would just meet up at a practice studio in the Barter Estate in Tilbury. And we'd just meet up and jam and we'd do covers. I played bass because two of the other members of the band were really good guitarists. And I was a shit guitarist. So I was like, I'll do bass then. Ross Lawson would come, who ended up doing all the instruments on No Commercial Breaks. He'd come. He was a multi-instrumentalist. He'd play guitar, he'd play keys, he'd play sax, all sorts of stuff. And we'd pootle about and do covers. And it was really good fun. Gay Bar.
Yeah.
By Electric Six. It was that era. We'd cover a lot of songs of that indie thing. But then also a bit of Doors, a bit of Hendrix, things like that. Hey Joe, as a bassist, was just the most fun thing to riff on. Because we'd if the singer hadn't turned up yet, we'd just start playing about with that.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding. And just so good to just loop round and build up.
What were you called?
Well, we needed a name when we got booked for a gig at the Fat Surfer.
Right.
And it was... We were called Royston Illa and the Motherfucking Posers. Because Ross Lawson, we decided he'll be Royston Illa and the Motherfucking Posers. Dave Henley was the lead singer and the talented person in the group, essentially. He was in loads of local bands at that point over the years. I proper idolised him. In my years of college, he was in a band and he'd get the bus to school and he had green hair and stuff. Mm. And I was like, too nervous to be doing any of that. So he was the talented one. I said I'd play bass. When we did 5 to 1 by the Doors, I'd sing that. And we got asked to do this gig. And we're like, all right, let's do a gig. That'll be a laugh.
Was you nervous?
Yeah, really nervous. Shit myself. And then Dave, who's played tons of gigs, done tons of stuff, said, oh, we'll start with 5 to 1. So I'm like, oh, we're starting with me playing bass and singing. And we did that and it went off. It was really good. We did the whole gig. People were losing their shit. Like, genuinely, I was like, fucking hell, this is amazing. People were going absolutely nuts. We had to do an encore. It was like, we hadn't planned an encore, but we had, I think it might have been Gay Bar that we hadn't put in our set list. That went off. I'm trying to think of other songs. It was all that kind of era. So there would have been a Stroke song in there and all that kind of thing. And it was fucking cool, man. Like, it proper, as I said, the reaction was huge. People were really into it. And I'd seen tons of bands at the Lunar Club, at the Lunar Club and at the Fat Surfer that 50-50.
Yeah,
people will not be giving any reaction. They'll be playing their hearts out and people will just be talking or trying to pull or whatever. Yeah. But we had people actually come on. And again, as someone who's promoted there, who did promote there for many years, you know that people will often stay around the edges.
Oh, always, yeah.
We had people on the dance floor from the first song and they were dancing and enjoying it. And it was cool. And they asked us to come back and do their... They had like a Boxing Day gig or something. Right. So it was some kind of in-between Christmas and New Year gig. And it was their big one. And they were like, can you headline this? I think we weren't headlining the first one, actually. I think we just played, but we stole the show. Because again, it's familiar songs, isn't it?
Yeah, cool.
You've got some random local band who are really good playing their own really good songs. It's not the same as hearing a Doors song or a Jimi Hendrix song. You like instantly go, this is easy. This is great. So yeah, we were like, oh, we got our second gig. This is going to be fucking cool. And then we got there and 3 of my exes, I think, were there. And I was like, oh.
What, they'd heard you'd become a superstar and like one of the sort of now one of the piece?
Probably not, but we're there. So me and the drummer, Mitch, I think he'd had a breakup or something at that point as well, or something like that. We just got hammered.
Right.
And Gareth as well, who was the guitarist, again, really talented. Me and Mitch weren't talented. greatest respect to Mitch. He'd learnt drums for this, basically. I'd learnt bass for this. So we knew these songs and that was it. There would be no, I'll let's riff or let's knock something out. I still don't know what any of the notes are or anything like that. I could play what I'd learnt.
Yeah.
That was it. Despite the amazing lessons from Joe Hymas, it did not go in. So I got hammered. Mitch got hammered. Gareth got quite hammered. Dave had a few drinks, but he's talented. You've got to remember that Dave and Gareth are talented.
Yeah.
So they can pull it off drunk. I got up there, couldn't remember anything. The first song we're doing, I'm playing it wrong. I'm like, oh, it's bass. And then I suddenly decided about halfway through, I was like, as it's bass, it's probably better to just not play anything than to play it wrong.
Good idea.
So I start miming.
Right.
So I'm pretending, just closing my eyes, having a little, trying to not show how nervous and awkward I am.
Yeah.
Again, I've had one experience of ever being on stage, and it was like the fucking Beatles.
Yeah.
Girls were screaming, everyone was going nuts. Experience number two, very much not that.
Yeah.
So I'm just pretending. And one of the people from HMV, I remember Tracy Ann, was in the front row, clearly seeing that me and Mitch are struggling. I remember her shouting, "Be sexy. Be sexy."
Oh,
I'm like, okay, no. So I don't know how I just continue to kind of mime, but try and look a bit cool with it.
Oh, God.
Again, poor Dave. He's having to hold this together.
Yeah.
And it's the bass and the drums.
It's the rhythm section, mate.
The rhythm section. It's the key bit. The guitarists can't save that.
No.
So, yeah, we ended up coming off after, I think, three songs, maybe four songs. And we're playing, all good.
Yeah.
Or again, I'm faking it. And then Dave goes, "All right, cheers, night." And we walk off and we're halfway through our set and we go off. And this is how drunk I am. I'm like, I don't take my bass off you yet. I'm like, are we doing the encore? Or
I
just walked off halfway through. So I had the highs and lows really early on of live.
Yeah.
And kind of that's the beauty of it in a way, because that's the birth of, I saw enough to want it.
Mm.
If you know what I mean. I've seen the really positive side of this can be glorious.
Mm.
And I've seen the horrible side of this can be the worst thing in the world. This can be absolute hell. So yeah, that was Royston Illa and the motherfucking Posers was my first experience of these things. Dave and Gareth and a few of the other, I think it was only them two from the band, went on to do a band called White Girl, who were really good. And they kind of started to blow up a bit. And it never really happened. But I remember I had far more fun attending their gigs than being part of it. I was like, oh, my place is on this side.
Yeah.
That was nice. That one off was a anomaly, but I'm better on this side, just having a drink, enjoying the bands and championing them. Yeah.
And it's interesting. Obviously, we're going to talk about various live experiences that you've had in your career in music, starting with a band and almost finishing back up in a band. But I want to then sort of strip it down now for the next bit and ask about those early spoken word shows and thinking, okay, right, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to write, and by what means am I going to get this across? And so was there ever, even back then, a kind of, should I start a band with this? Or was it, I'm going to just test this out on a spoken word scene? Because for me, and, you know, being sort of in and around the circles of people that you will be around at that time point in your life, spoken word wasn't something that was happening around where we lived.
Not at all.
And so how did that turn into something that become an integral part of that scene? And we should mention that at some point we'll do an episode talking about that scene.
Yeah, 100%. So I've got kind of a stock interview answer to this,
mm-hmm.
and it is that I wanted to do spoken word because you live and die on your own merits. Mm. You've not, again, we've all been in bands where the drummer isn't as committed and they're not turning up to practice. Mm. And you can fail, but you can, in the back of your mind, go, it's the drummer's fault, or the bassist isn't into it, or whatever. I didn't want to have anyone else to blame other than myself if it doesn't work. But the realization from this conversation now is more, I didn't want to be the one to blame for a band failing. Because that's genuinely it. In the other bands I was in, I was the weak point.
Yeah.
So doing the spoken word thing, it's like, right, if this is shit, I'm only ruining my own career and my own chances. If I'm in a band, I'm ruining everyone's.
I get what you're saying, but also when you're in a band and if something doesn't quite go to plan, it's not always going to be on you, but you've got a gang with you.
Yeah.
And to walk out on stage on your own, you know, you are putting yourself out there, and that's a brave thing to do. And And you've got a stammer.
Yeah,
and you're basically then going to go and publicly talk on your own. That, to me, that's a brave move. Yeah. And like, so them early spoken word shows, I don't know how much consideration you gave your stammer ahead of that, but what I want you to talk me through some of them early spoken word shows. And did you have a pre, I don't know if you call it, are they gigs when you do spoken word, are they called gigs? Mm-hmm. Did you have a pre-gig routine?
Well, again, that's where it's kind of interesting. As someone who, you know, at this point in my life, overthinks everything so much. Mm. So many of the brave moments in my life are just me underthinking. Yeah. I didn't think about it. And so kind of before those spoken word gigs was the Relying on the Kindness of Strangers tour, which I did with Chris a lot of it. So I decided to get in a van with Chris and tour around the country, just playing on street corners. If there was open mics, going and doing them.
So that was before the spoken word shows?
That was before I'd done anything. And again, it's mind-blowing now because I look back and it didn't cross my mind, but I quit my job and it was a career at that point. I'd been working in HMV for 5 years and I'd been climbing the ladder as such. As much as people turn their nose up at retail, I enjoyed it. I made some good mates and I was making a career of it. So I quit that to go and do music without even thinking about the fact, I don't know if I can do this. Mm. And as I've said before, I credit Chris for being a key part in that, because I remember getting to that first performance and my ass going, like completely going, oh, maybe I'll leave this. But because Chris was there going, well, go on then. Like, we've driven up here. Mm. You're going to do it. And I did it. And then I did more. And these were all outside, which meant, and they were up north, most of them.
So you're essentially playing to queues outside gigs.
Queues outside gigs. The first ever one was outside a DJ Shadow album playback at his label. So at Universal or wherever it was, there's a queue there. I was like, I'll do a gig. Then that same night we went and did it outside the Buck 65 gig at the Barfly. And in that queue was Buddy Peace and Orpheus. Orpheus ended up producing a beat on Distraction Pieces, the album. Buddy Peace produces Distraction Pieces and this podcast. Mm. So hadn't met. It was just pure chance.
Yeah.
That was the first impression. But they were just the two London ones. I think we might have done Atmosphere a couple of weeks later. But then we got in the van and went Midlands. And the plan there was to play on street corners. Those two had happened because by chance we were on our way out and we were like, oh, there's some gigs in town. Let's go there. We got into the Midlands or wherever else. Playing on street corners ain't the one. No one gives a shit.
Yeah.
Particularly for spoken word.
Yeah.
I'd either be doing it a cappella or I'd have the beats on a tape deck or I'd beatbox into a loop pedal and rap over the top. So all good fun, but no one's interested. So yeah, it was then that we started to get to each town, grab an enemy or something, or not even buy it. We'd go into a shop and look at local gig listings and go and play outside other people's gigs. So we played outside just tons of different bands and DJs. I remember Mr. Scruff won. I think that was in Oxford. So we were on our way out then.
Have you met any of these artists since? And then said, I started off gigging outside your gigs.
I met Buck, but didn't really talk about it.
You had Shadow on the podcast,
obviously. Shadow on the podcast. Yeah, I don't think I mentioned it to him.
Yeah. Oh, you should have, man.
Yeah, I really should have. Or maybe I did. I can't remember, but I don't think I did. But yeah, so there was a load of that. And that kind of leads back to those spoken word gigs. It was a fucking breeze after that.
Yeah.
After playing in Manchester Town Centre on the day of an England game that's being played at Old Trafford.
Yeah, that's a baptism of fire, isn't it?
It was rough, mate. So we were like, yeah, that ain't working. And we moved on to Leeds as if we wanted a friendlier place to go and play.
Yeah.
So we did loads of them. And yeah, as I said, that meant that going and playing spoken word gigs where they're expecting a gig and they want to see you do stuff. But also I think subconsciously those Royston Illa and the motherfucking Posers gigs play into it.
Yeah.
Because although I didn't know if I could play live, I'd fucking rehearse the fuck out of all of it. I knew all of it. So it meant that when I was turning up at these gigs, like no one at that Shadow album playback thought that was my first gig.
Yeah.
No one at Buck 65. And then we did all these ones up north. And the idea was, I've got my suit on, I've got my trucker cap on, or at least my shirt and tie, my trucker cap. I've got my big beard. I've got my CDs. I've pressed my CDs. The idea was they're going to assume I'm big down south.
Yeah.
because I knew my shit. Like, it was a polished show. I didn't know if it was good.
Mm.
That's the bit that I still maintain is the biggest mistake I could have done. But I knew it, and I know I could perform it well. I wasn't going to be reading off paper or a phone. I was going to be getting there and smashing it and performing it, not just reciting poems. I was going to be performing. And that happened on all these street corners outside all these gigs. So it meant that when I got back to do the spoken word scene in London and in Southend, I was polished, man.
Yeah.
And particularly open mics. Open mics, everyone is getting up and they're mumbling and they've not prepared any stage.
Do people get heckled like at them sort of gigs? Or is it a pretty kind crowd?
Normally pretty kind and chill. Open mics in particular, everyone's just waiting for their go.
Mm.
It's just, they're not going to be horrible to you because they've got to get up in a minute.
Yeah.
But with rap and spoken word, I'd been to a load of rap gigs in that era that had been rubbish because rap, particularly in the UK, had come up in the studio, hadn't come up on a live scene or come up as behind decks being an MC, not a live show.
Sure.
But I'd grown up, as we've discussed, going to punk gigs.
Mm.
So I was like, no, I want to have impact. I want to hit stuff. I want to have passion, aggression if needed. Mm. And it meant, I think, I made some big impacts in those early scenes. Like, I got to a really good standing in the spoken word scene within a few months of performing.
Yeah.
Because everyone assumed I'd been around for ages. I probably did open mics for a few weeks and then I was getting booked for gigs. And you can be on the open mic circuit for years, but because I was getting up there, and I said, it's pure set and setting. The fact that everyone else is getting up nervously and going, I want to try a poem for the first time, holding it in their hand, again, often doing some amazing stuff. It's going to make me look even better when I'm getting up.
Yeah.
And I know it inside and out. Even if I've got a story that goes into it, I know my 5 minutes. Mm. And it felt like a breeze because of that baptism of fire, of being on street corners. Yeah. On that tour, though, before getting back, I played, Dan Lesac booked me for my first ever gig.
Yeah.
And that's where I knew him from HMV days, again, as we've discussed. And we've discussed the gig on the Dan Lesac episode. But yeah, that was where that happened. So that was all within the first 2 weeks of ever doing anything as Scroobius as Pip on stage. Yeah. You know? It's a weird one.
I mean, we go into quite a lot of the how a lot of the stuff you just mentioned with Dan come about on that episode. But there's some things that I want to sort of... When you got with Dan and started making music, was live always going to happen?
Yeah, I think so.
Or was it going to be a studio project?
It was always going to happen as soon as the songs were out there.
Yeah.
Like, as we've touched on, Dan and Pip was never a planned thing.
Yeah.
We did some remixes and stuff and it blew up. But that meant that had an interesting influence on the live side of things because it meant that we would play into the decent sized crowds, number one, before I knew the lyrics to half the songs.
Yeah.
And we'd get praised for my theatrics on stage. Part of that was I had a big Bible that I was reading the commandments out of. It's because I didn't know thou shalt.
Yeah.
And letter from God to man, I'd get a letter out and say, this is a letter from God to man. And then I'd read it, but it'd get more performative and more anxious and aggressive and angry in places. But that was, again, that wasn't miming. Yeah. I was reading that.
Yeah,
I didn't know the lyrics. And there was a few like that. On our first headline tour, I had one for Tommy C. I did it as kind of a news reporter. I'd be behind a desk and we had Jim had rigged up a camera so it could be on the TV behind us. So I'd be on the TV and at the desk.
Yeah.
And that was because, it was another song. We had to quickly get an album out somewhere because we had these gigs and we had this audience. So I'd do that as a news reader so I could have the lyrics in front of me because I hadn't learnt them. So, yeah, it's weird. A lot of the theatrics that we got known for were a method to get them done.
Yeah.
But it also meant that the other stuff I knew well enough to really smash it out so you wouldn't notice.
Yeah.
You wouldn't assume, he doesn't know what he's doing. I've covered it up.
Yeah.
You know, after talking about nervous people with the lyrics in front of them, it's like, right, no, you dress that up and make it seem like it's a strength rather than a weakness.
I was going to ask to sort of talk about like the gigs in the initial boom of hype that come with Thou Shalt. And I know we talk about that quite a bit on Dan's episode, but what I want to talk about in regards to them live shows is one of the things, and you know, you've mentioned there, and I don't think in my mind that cheapens anything whatsoever that you know, if you was reading it for that gig, if that enabled you to to do, you know, Letter from God with that much more venom and spite and passion, then that's performance. And so many of them songs, Tommy C, and that you've mentioned, of, I don't need to tell you the amount of people that have been affected by songs and have probably reached out and sent you messages over the years and things like that. That sort of, that weight that them songs have with so many people, did you ever carry that weight when you'd walk on stage and know that them people were out there and them words that you're saying have, you know, directly affected them and been part of their life? And
I think weirdly I carried it as a responsibility. Like, there was definitely a period of me and Dan where he wanted to play less of the miserable songs, of the heavy songs. But for me, it was like, right, we can't talk about this stuff on the album. Because again, at that point, particularly anything about suicide and death, at that point, you weren't getting that addressed in music much.
Yeah.
So I was like, we can't have that on the album and then live be the fun party band. Yeah. We have to have that variation. And again, I'd add weird theatrics. Again, on that first tour, I used to do a bit that Dan hated on this one song that I'd nicked off a Russian clown, Slava, Slava Snow Show. He'd do a thing where there's a...
Oh, you love that, didn't you?
Yeah, I really do love it. It's amazing. It's honestly the best, consistently the best live experience I've ever had.
Yeah.
And I've had sex multiple times. But he'd do a thing where there's a coat hanger with a long coat on it on a hat stand, and there's a hat. And at some point, he'll slip his hand into the arm and it will seem like it's brought to life because the hat is just in the position to be the head, and then the arm will grab him and hug him and all that. And I rip that off. I'd hold a sign up to say this is from Slava Poliniak. I can't remember. Dan hated that arty shit. Because again, Dan came from the dance music scene. Yeah, so he wants to get to the songs that bang and all this. And I'm going, let's do this one where I'm having a deep emotional moment with a coat.
But them opposite perspectives always bring out the best in both, right?
Yeah. Again, I enjoyed all of that. I always wanted to try and bring unusual things because of having a varied taste in live stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I did go to a lot of different things, so I didn't want to just be MC and DJ.
Yeah.
Like, it's why Dan would do everything actually live. Again, I'm sure we touch on sometimes to his detriment. He'd give himself too much to do because he was paranoid that people think he's back there just pressing play and then checking his emails.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was important to give any song the weight it deserved, if you know what I mean. Particularly songs that are going to have that emotional attachment. A Magician's Assistant was one that for years Dan wanted to drop, and he changed the beat numerous times to make it work more for him live. Mm-hmm. But for me, that was one that was like, no, I need to have that in there because we need to show that we can talk about these things, and it can be in a room full of people. It's not our secret. It's not only on the album when we listen to it at home and it's a secret, but when we're out in public, we don't talk about stuff like that. It was like, no, we need to have that at the gig. And we'd always plan the set list out. So we bring things back up. We'd end on a Letter from God to Man and Dan cutting it up. And so you end on a party. And the idea was we send them out beaming and then maybe on the train home, they're like, how about that one about suicide, man? Mm. And you know, there might be these heavier things that they end up discussing on the way home, which sounds really controlling and manipulative or over the top. But I liked the idea of coming away from the gig and it being more than just, oh, that was a laugh.
Yeah, of course. You know,
and it can just be a laugh. And 90% of people, it would have just been, no, that was mad.
Yeah.
I crowd surfed, I did this, I did that. But it was important to have those bits that maybe give you more to connect to and think about.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
As the shows got bigger and more regular, did you form routines? So tell me about, like, literally from arriving at a venue to sound check to what you do pre-walkout and post-gig, you know, what was it, with Dan, without Dan? Like,
yeah, I mean, my clearest memories of pre-gig are always with Dan and with B. Dolan. So B. Dolan supported us on numerous tours. He brought the art of screaming or something into our life, which was like a DVD that a lot of metal bands used, and it was some woman doing a vocal warm-up, and it was stupid and ridiculous. In hindsight, I don't think it helped me at all.
Sounds horrid.
It was really funny. It's like, me, like all that kind of thing. And me and Dolan would be doing it and cracking up. But I didn't have that much of a process. So I would get there, we'll sound check. Again, you know how organized I am, and I don't want things to be a rush. And also, I always wanted our support acts to have time to have a proper sound check, because if things are running late, it's always at their cost. And we've been that support band before where it's like, you can sound check now, doors open in 10, you're on in 30.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of horrible thing of, right, that's rough. So we wanted that. But so with sound check, I'd often go for a bit of a walk around a town. You know, I'm a weirdo like that. But pre-gig, either we'd just be hanging out and chatting, pissing about, enjoying the support act. Again, we brought people like Dolan and Kay Tempest and people like that on tour with us. So we'd normally have stuff that is going to fire us up regardless, because they're really good live acts. But if not, I know there was periods where I'd listen, I'd put my headphones on and put on some Glassjaw, and At the Drive-In were quite go-to stuff, because they really go back to my aggressive, angsty kind of teen days and fire you up. But particularly with the Dan Lesac stuff, we'd either open with the Beat Them Heart Skipped or Stunner.
Yeah.
So they were ones that punched the audience in the face instantly. So you get that energy.
Yeah.
I remember when I was doing my Edinburgh Fringe run, the first gig I did, I was like, right, I need to figure out a process, because I didn't have the injection of energy that comes from Dan dropping a beat and the crowd going mad. Yeah. So I shared a venue with Angelos and with John Shuttleworth, two veterans of the Fringe and all that. And they were both doing new characters.
Yeah.
They'd finish their gig and come back to the cupboard dressing room.
Yeah.
There'd be some bearded poet in there doing push-ups and sit-ups. Because I was trying to get my energy out, just trying to get my heart rate, or jogging on the spot. Because, again, I said I did that first one. And when I was doing the live band stuff, we'd always open with Introduction, which was the biggest song off that record.
Yeah.
It was a big thing for me and Dan as well. I was always like, don't save the biggest song till the end.
Mm.
Everyone's knackered at the end. And that came because I went to see Public Enemy do It Takes a Nation of Millions in order at Brixton, which means they start with their biggest song.
Yeah.
And the energy, I've never seen a room explode like that. Again, you'll normally start with a decent sized song, but the big one comes later on.
Yeah.
To get that biggest song at the start when everyone's waiting and got that anticipation, I was like, that's how we do it live. So Beat Them, Heart Skipped, and Stunner were always big singles for me and Dan. And Introduction was the biggest solo single I've had. And we'd open with that every time, because it'd just make people fucking explode. And then it's our job to keep that going.
Yeah.
It's our job to keep that energy up and to keep that
that
vibe in the room. It's good to put pressure on yourselves like that.
Those early gigs with Dan and first tours, I remember coming to see one of them, and I remember my mate Mark eating all your rider. Your rider back then seemed to be essentially sweets.
Sweets and crisps.
How bad and unhealthy was your rider then compared to maybe what your last one was?
It's a mix, because riders are quite standard at that level. Like, it's hard to get things other than here's some snacks, here's some meat and some bread and some beers. So I definitely found in the later end of my career, where I was trying to just get like some elderflower press.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
That was so hard to get. And in my mind, I'm like, that's cheaper than getting a six pack of fucking Red Stripe. but it was so hard to make these small demands. So yeah, I don't think particularly our rider was particularly steered towards us, but yeah, there would be sweets and crisps because me and Dan would both just, I wouldn't eat a lot before a gig, but maybe if I was, some sugary sweets are going to do me better than a bread roll.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, I guess it varied a bit, but again, I was also that annoying prick who, so I turned 30 whilst we were touring, I guess, in that touring era. And I was aware that my metabolism isn't going to look after me forever. So I would bring resistance bands on tour and stuff like that. And I'd just be doing little workouts and little exercise stuff. Because as you say,
You and Dan?
Just me. And on the stuff with the band as well. Like sometimes the rest of the lads would want to do stuff, but I'd have a skipping rope, all sorts of stuff. Because, all joking aside, it can be a really unhealthy
thing.
And I realised that particularly at that point, again, I'm on the band stuff more now, but I'm with Dan, I'd drink a bottle of rosé on stage and I'd get through most of that bottle each night. If we're doing 6 gigs a week, I'm drinking 6 bottles of rosé a week.
Mm.
That's not great.
No.
That's not fantastic. And there was no drinking problem. I'm lucky I've never struggled with anything there. The adrenaline normally meant I was barely getting a buzz from it. It was maybe just leveling things out a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're coming off stage when any healthy food options aren't a choice. So you're getting a greasy pizza or whatever in your hotel room at night. So yeah, weirdly, I added fitness stuff into the touring life to try and go, right, let's try not to die.
And also, if you put in a lot of, as you did, a lot of energy into your live shows, you have to be fight fit to do that anyway.
That was it as well. I was, as I touched upon early on, I was like, right, I need to approach these like punk gigs. I want to be going 100 miles an hour. I want to be jumping in the crowd surfing, stage diving, all of this stuff. And that will knacker you.
Mm.
Again, I know I've got older, but I genuinely think if I'd got into fitness a bit earlier, I would have been in amazing shape then because I was doing an hour to 90 minutes of cardio every night.
Yeah.
Because doing all that running around. And again, that there was also an element, particularly before I was doing stuff with a band, that I was like, well, this is just me and Dan.
Yeah.
We were pressured at points to add a band as we're getting in bigger and bigger venues, but we were adamant Dan doesn't get a band in to write the album.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't have one for live. And we couldn't add that much. And
financially, it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense. Have a session musicians or whatever. So yeah, Dan was always, as I said, Dan would always make sure he's doing loads live, but I was also aware that I've got to fill this stage.
Yeah.
Like we can't afford to bring a full tour backdrop or what, like we had different things over different tours. Mm. But the thing to me was, I don't want this stage to look too big for us.
Mm.
So I would be constantly side to side, back, forward, in the crowd, going through the crowd, rapping, coming back over the barrier, climb up on stage, finish off the song. It was energetic.
Yeah.
And that was a conscious choice, I guess. That was really, I always remember when Dan Hardy, came to see me and Dan play in Nottingham at Rescue Rooms. And Dan Hardy, MMA legend, I was a big fan of him.
Mm.
We'd met a couple of times at UFC events. I was like, I'll come to my gig. Yeah, I'd enjoy it. But knowing Dan was a punk, before that gig started, I was like, I need to impress Dan. And the speed with which I was fucking launching myself into the crowd and getting back on stage and finishing the song and not missing a beat. I've heard him talk on numerous different things about Pip's fucking mental life. He's a lunatic. And that was, again, I'd always be rowdy, but I remember that one specifically. I remember doing a bit where Dan cuts it up in the middle of a song. I remember crowd surfing all the way to the bar, getting a shot, doing a shot on top of the crowd, then crowd surfing back exactly in time for the song to kick in again.
Wonderful.
And finishing it off and feeling like a fucking a lunatic.
As the sort of the sort of size of the band grew and grew and grew, and you end up, you know, playing ridiculously big shows. You end up playing all the huge festivals, and you know some of them shows that you know you've done with was Billy Bragg and
Coco.
What was the Wembley Arena?
Wembley with Frank Turner. Yeah.
Like, you know, when you're walking out to crowds like that and the crowds that you would have played to at the festivals and things like that, like, tell me, did you have a kind of grip on the nerves?
Team no nerves, mate. Again, I don't think I talked to self-esteem about this. I did a podcast recently with self-esteem, and I'd heard them speak on another podcast about not getting nervous. I had that for my whole music career. I didn't really get nervous. The most nervous I've been was when we were doing a cover of a Billy Bragg song with Billy Bragg.
Yeah.
That got me a bit. And that was more in the sound check. I was like, I'm looking across and like, I'm about to sing the opening verse with Billy Bragg playing it on guitar. This is weird.
And excellent.
And excellent. But other than that, nah, no nerves. It was a breeze. It was always exciting. I remember that Wembley gig being, my main thought was, right, I need to get back and DJ at Lizards. Because we had the club night on
that
night.
That's right.
So I left Wembley, came and DJ'd at Lizards while Frank was on. So Frank was kind enough.
So you'd done your piece and then fucked off. Didn't you sing a song about that?
Yeah. Rude, isn't it?
Done your shitty little gig.
Yeah.
And then fucked off for Frank.
Yeah. I watched a bit of Frank and then went and did my DJ set in the basement of the book club. But yeah, weirdly never nervous because it was always excitement. It's the reason I managed to stop with no regrets playing live was because it was excitement to play them these songs that we've worked really hard on. And once I played all them songs so many times to so many people, I was like, that excitement was gone kind of thing. Well, not gone, but I knew it would go. So once I stopped, there wasn't any urge to get back up there. I completely would have thought it was about the buzz and the adoration and the crowds. I've not missed it at all. And that was because the excitement was, oh, I've got this new song and I want them all to hear it and I want to perform it. And again, I'm confident in how I'm going to perform it. I want to get all that emotion and energy out. I think I heard again on another podcast recently, I think it was Tim Key talking about saying how his brother is far more outgoing than him. And he's realized it's because he's got an outlet.
Yeah.
And that was me. You know, I'm not an outgoing, like, on nights out or whatever, I'm not an outgoing guy at all. But it was because I had an outlet. I had that. I can go and get that, what you need from that bit of attention or that bit of expressing yourself. I could go and do that every night on tour. And then when I'm done, I'm like again, tour buses were always hilarious. I'd have to let new support acts, because support acts are normally come in the van with us a lot of time. I'd have to let them know that I'm fine. I'm not angry. They haven't done anything wrong. I'm just chilling, because I'd just be sitting there. Yeah, I'm just boring.
I'd just be
sitting there with the greatest hits of Cyndi Lauper in my headphones, playing a game on my Game Boy or whatever, and just, or reading or my laptop. I remember having a hard drive that had every Pride fight ever.
Yeah.
So I'd be in the back of the van just watching Pride fights.
For most people, they won't understand. That's a really good time right there.
Yeah. I was in heaven. But again, it was a weird thing, because a lot of people on tours, you're all, like, all that excitement's there and you're fired up. Dan would be quite loud and quite, particularly, because again, it's natural. You've got all this adrenaline. Yeah.
And that's Dan.
Mm. But I'd be so, that was all I needed. I'll have that hour on stage. Other than that, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need, it's why I was never big after party guy or anything like that. Because, like, no, I did my bit.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I don't need any more attention. I don't need any praise. I'm just going to go and chill.
So was that something that made, kind of, obviously with the solo record, you put together a band for the first time? And so did that make, was that pretty much your approach to touring with the band then as well? Just like, look, you know, we'll get it out of our systems on stage, and then the rest of the time, let's do what we got to do to stay sane.
100%. And again, on those tours, B. Dolan was another, just because again, he was more experienced in touring as well. So, but yeah, exactly that. We got the band together, auditioned a load of drummers. Quake was one of the ones who auditioned, who plays on a lot of K Tempest stuff. Absolute legend, but he didn't fit. But Paul Glover turned up. Like, we auditioned three drummers, I think, in one day, maybe four, and we wanted them to play over in Tradition, where the drums are by Travis Barker. So it's a tough one. We'd given them a couple of songs to practice. The first two came in, did their thing before. I said, obviously, it's really hard to play over a song that's got drums on, so we'll do our best. Well, I completely understand that. And they did fine. But again, it is hard to play over something that drums are already there. Paul turned up, was like, right. Then didn't give any precursor or warning point. Played it absolutely beat perfect, absolutely amazing. On to the next song. Okay, on to the next one. Played that absolutely perfect. Was like, okay, so I'll hear from you or whatever. And it was instantly, as soon as he walked out of the room, me and Warren were like, let's get him.
Yeah.
Like, Quake, for example. He's fucking cool. He's got big dreadlocks.
Yeah.
He's got his glasses. He's a fucking cool guy.
Yeah.
But we're like, do we want to pick a cool guy?
Yeah.
Or the person who's going to nail it every single night?
Yeah, of course.
And not be a nightmare at all. And not that, that Quake would have been a nightmare.
Yeah.
But we, also, we'd seen someone who was just a professional. And again, turned out to be a good lad as well.
Yeah.
But on that thing, it was like each of the other guys probably seemed like the cool, more rock and roll option at that point. And Paul just turned up, was like, I will not miss a beat.
Yeah.
The whole tour.
That's what you want.
Do you want that? We're like, yeah, let's have that. Absolutely. And then, yeah, it was exactly that. But not to throw anyone under the bus, Warren and Paul hadn't had as much tour experience as us at that point. So me and B were a lot better at the let's have our moment, then call it a night and go to bed.
Yeah, yeah.
And Warren and Paul were a bit more, should we go out to a bar?
Yeah.
And Soundman Jim, again, on that tour. We'd got Jim back for that one. they were a bit more, me and B, more than happy to go back to the hotel. And they're more kind of, should we go out for a drink? Because it was a good gig. It was really enjoyable. And our minds are like, well, we've got a month-long tour. I know that go out for a drink ends up being out all night. We've got another gig tomorrow.
Yeah.
Boringly professional. But they were the more kind of, let's go and party.
Talk me through the last ever show. Like, was there nerves ahead of that?
Yeah, there probably was, actually. There was emotions, at least. At least there were big emotions, because it was best of all, it had been announced as our last ever show. And that was kind of our home show. I've got on my laptop at home, the screensaver I've got is us at Best of All one year. And there's at least 20,000 people in front of us. So I'm down the front just on the mic, just running past. There's at least 20,000, because we had this main stage slot. We didn't clash with anyone. So it was one of them. It's not they were all there for us, but it was one of them where if there's not much on, you head towards the main stage, really.
Sweet.
And it went really well. And we had this amazing gig. And we had numerous, like, we had years of different playing on this stage and it being rammed outside the tent and all this. So we had that. It was going to be at Best of All. Rob the Bank had signed us, was going to introduce us. My mum and dad were in the crowd, a few friends and family, and obviously a whole load of fans. The tent was rammed, outside the tent was rammed. And yeah, there were nerves. It was a weird one, not kind of knowing what to say to Dan, because it's kind of like, here we go. Like, this is it. And I think we probably did hug afterwards, maybe, but I'm not sure what we did beforehand, because again, we're not really huggy people kind of thing. But yeah, again, if there were nerves, it was excitement almost immediately. I do remember, actually, there was one period, I've just remembered, where I had nerves, and it was this crossover between the live band and me and Dan. So I'd been doing the live band stuff for a while. Me and Dan had never had a rehearsal.
Yeah.
I'd practice on my own, he'd practice on his own. Then we'd maybe sit in the van and go over some bits. But there was a period where I'd been touring with the live band. That was coming to an end, and me and Dan were going to start our final kind of tours. Yeah. And a festival booked me and the live band on the main stage and had a dance tent. They said, will you and Dan be up for doing the dance tent later in the day? The main stage gig went amazing. Circle pits, mosh pits, loved it all. Knocking back the rosé. Then the adrenaline stops. And by the time we get to mine and Dan's gig, I'm not drunk, but I'm not where I should be for the start of a gig. And we'd never practiced because we were just gigging constantly from day one.
Mm.
We didn't need to practice because we're doing five gigs a week. That is practice. And there was, I always remember we were doing Look for the Woman, and I'd practiced all the new songs, but I hadn't been going over the old songs. I didn't know it. It was fucking heartbreaking. Like, we got to a point and I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
Can't remember the words. And I kind of played it. I was like, can someone remind me? And someone gave me a bit and I did it. And then I lost the words again. Or Dan started again, and we went through it again. And then in the end, I had to just kind of style it out, and we just did the choruses. It was fucking embarrassing. I've never had that.
We did at the Fat Surfer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It flashed back to that moment. It flashed back to that 100%. And me and Dan were headlining a festival the next day. And in the hotel that night, I downloaded every song we've ever written.
How much of a nerd out you would have had then?
Yeah, the whole van on the way there, I was listening over and over our stuff, and I never listened to our stuff. Yeah. It's weird, but over and over, just practicing it. And then we did this gig, and it went amazing. It was headlining a festival, which was mad, like the main stage of this festival. Yeah. And it went great, but that was one of the times I was nervous going on stage, because again, I'd got too relaxed. Speaking of never having any nerves, it bit me on the arse. I thought I could do a gig with my band, get drunk, be all, we're at a festival, and then going to another gig with Dan, having not practiced in a year or two at that point.
Yeah.
And just smash it. And that was a wake-up call. The one time I've had that kind of, remember, this isn't just a given.
Yeah.
You've got to work at this as well. So yeah. But yeah, that last gig was then a joy. And yeah, we finished it, had a hug with Rob the Bank and Dan and Sarah from Sunday Best and stuff like that. And then I had to host the spoken word tent in about half an hour.
Business as usual.
So I rushed off and hosted the spoken word. And that was the weirdest thing, to have done that with that crowd.
Yeah.
And then it's not even me, it's me going,
adrenaline dump.
Are you all right, everyone? And there was a good crowd there. But it's like, you're all right, everyone? And next is Kay Tempest or whoever else. It's like, man, that's the end of an era. An era has literally ended and I'm already on to the next thing. Weird,
well,
man.
We'll talk about that. Also, just if you can hear any sort of background noise, we're not auditioning drummers for Pip's next project. Somebody next to the studio has decided to start banging and drilling. So hopefully that's not too loud. Well, obviously, us and our friends make jokes at you at how frustrated you get when people continue to ask you, well, when's the next album out, Pip?
Yeah.
And just while we're talking, obviously, live, I've been to and been on stage with you at several live podcasts, mm-hmm. but you're still very, very selective and choice as to when and if you do them.
Yeah.
So just to sort of wrap things up, where's your head at now with being on stage, entertaining a live audience in whatever format?
Not into it, man. I'm not into it. I don't get any buzz from it. It's why I've stopped doing the live podcasts. Again, I enjoy them, but there's more nerves on them than there ever was on the gigs. And yeah, I don't know. It was a big realization that the whole point of live was to show people this stuff that we've worked really hard on, rather than to get praise or adoration or money. And then again, the money's a big part of it as well. That's why you tour, and that's why, particularly when the arse was dropping out of music in general. But yeah, that, it doesn't appeal to me. I've been at mates' gigs, people like Sage and Dolan, who I've done songs with, who will always say beforehand, if you want to, like, we'll do that song. It's always like, no, I'd rather watch. I'd rather just be there enjoying it. I feel I won't do anything on stage again until I need to.
Yeah.
And let me explain that, until it's beneficial to me. So I can see, for example, if I get one of the films I'm trying to get made, I can see me, I've said a few times to people, the films I want to make aren't big commercial things at the moment. So if I get to make any of them, I'll tour them like a record. I'll take my experience from gigs. So I'll do a Q&A. I'll spend a month doing Q&A's up and down the country at all these different screenings. I'll do a bit of, you know, get someone else up. I'll do a podcast afterwards. I'll do anything to get people in. So if there's something, if I can use live to benefit where my focus and passion is now, all right, I'll do something. I can't see me doing any music or gigs again, but you never know. Again, I still feel if something happened that I was like, right, I've got this stuff I want to do, then maybe I could see it happening. But again, the more distance I get from it, the more it feels like that's a different person, and I can't see it happening again. But yeah, they'll get asked all the time by people who don't realise I'm not doing that anymore. Whether it be people in the music industry or people in the acting or podcast or whatever else. I had Fatboy Slim recently hit me up asking if I'll perform at one of his events he's doing. And I was like, no, man, not.
Yeah, but then that makes you think, that's obviously testament to the fact that you're more passionate about acting and podcasting than you are, because offers like that come along once in a lifetime. And if you're not feeling it, then you don't feel like you're going to be able to do it, what the justice it probably deserves, because your passion is elsewhere, then you should follow your passions always. You know, it's definitely something, you know, from a outsider looking at your career, something you've always done. And like, why change that?
It's weird. I didn't expect to be bringing up self-esteem so much in this episode, but we were talking about them before we started recording. But their album was called Prioritize Pleasure. And everyone kind of, a lot of interviews will be always, it's about wanking, it's about sex stuff. And part of it is, but also it's about prioritizing pleasure in life in general. And I think I got to that point. I was like, right, I really enjoyed all them gigs. I don't fancy it.
Yeah.
So when a gig offer comes in, it could be for tons of money. It could be a really good, you're on with this person or that person. Don't fancy it.
Yeah.
So rather than going, oh, but, you know, as you said, this is a great opportunity. You shouldn't turn this down. It's like, yeah, but I don't want to. Regardless of it being a great opportunity, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So I won't.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sit there and go, yeah, but, you know, you'll regret it if you don't. So far, I haven't.
Yeah.
I've turned down loads of gigs and so far, I've not regretted any of them. I've gone to some of them, had a wonderful time, and I've not been there thinking, I wish everyone was looking at me. I wish I was getting to do my song and they were looking. I wish everyone could see how great I am. I've not had that at all. I've been like, right, I'll just stay here. I'll watch everyone. It's wicked. I love it. So yeah, no desire to go back. But as I said, there is still, I always touch upon this. I do still have little song ideas come into my mind or write little lyrics. And so far, writing them is enough for me. Like the buzz I get from writing it, I don't feel any need for anyone else to hear it, to record it, to develop it at all. The buzz I get from coming up with a little rhyme or a little pattern, that's enough.
Yeah.
There might be a point one day. Again, it becomes less and less likely the further away I get away from it all, but there might be a chance at some point that I'm like, I need to record this or I need to write this or make this happen. Then if that happens, then it'll be because I want to, not because I'm like, oh, people keep tweeting me. I've had that tweet tip me over the edge.
Yeah.
As I've told you before, there was a point that the tweets were the thing that were guaranteeing I'm not going to make any more music because they were just getting annoying. It was like, I found an old DM the other day. Someone hit me up about a gig. They said, I hit you up a few years back and I saw the first one. And the first one was, I'm taking a year or two off from live. Give me a shout down the line. So it was interesting to see that I'd kind of forgotten that it wasn't a hard line stop from the start. It was originally, I'm taking a pause.
Yeah.
And then it's just become harder and harder. And that's because of, number one, falling in love with another area. And number two, being a stubborn little prick. So when there was that period where everything I'd pour my heart into, I'd release something new.
Yeah.
And everyone would just be, doing any more music? Do this and like, oh, fuck off. I'm never doing any more.
But then people can you know, get to see Scroobius Pip performing in your new career. It's not even a new career now. In your career as actor. Obviously, we do an episode on acting.
Yeah.
And also, if they miss your voice, you've been putting out like a podcast a week for the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, and that's what was interesting, man, because there's episodes of the podcast that I'm as proud of, if not more proud of, than any of the songs I ever wrote.
Yeah.
The refugee special and the safe housing for women special are some of the best things I've done in my career. Mm. And I sometimes hope that people who miss the music realize that. Yeah. That it's not just I'm just doing a podcast now because it's easy or because this or because that. It's like, no, there's stuff there that I think is as impactful or more impactful than anything I've ever written. And it's just conversations. And again, the reason I mentioned the divorce episode is that episode with my mum and dad, because I said, I tried to write about that. The amount of times I tried to write about it or tried to find an angle on it, and it felt icky.
Yeah.
It felt horrible. It felt like too much of an emotional thing to be going, here's a song.
Yeah.
79p on iTunes.
Yeah.
It was like, no, I can't turn it into that. So yeah. And same with this, as I said, script writing. Script writing is the weird thing that I've had a 4 or 5 year journey on that no one knows about. Like, there's been stuff in development. I've got better. I've learned things, but it's not been public.
Mm.
Like, it's not been stuff that's out there. So that's a really interesting area, because it's like, all right, people don't realise there's loads of other stuff going on that I'm just, it's my absolute passion. But it's a weird one. I can't remember where I was going on there. I normally find a really nice way to round these up, but this time I've stumbled to an end.
I'm trying to think how we can finish this one. When's the new record out?
There we go. That was all the stories of playing live. And I'm furious you weren't already familiar with Royce Danila and the motherfucking Posers. The greatest cover band to ever play two gigs and then split up.
I bet the rest of that band, if they listen to this podcast, must be thinking, why has he brought that up? I really tried to bury that. Only me and my therapist know about this.
Oh, that was it. As I touched upon, everyone else in it was so much more talented than me. I was originally going to be the guitarist, and then we met a second more talented guitarist. Yeah. That's why I became the bassist.
Yeah, it must kill them that you went on to have a successful music career.
Yeah, heartbreaking, heartbreaking. Thank you all for tuning in. As we said at the intro, we're past the halfway point now, so there's two episodes to go back and enjoy, and two more to come. And please like, subscribe and all that business, and chat to us on the socials. Right? We will be doing a series two. We've got a long list of things that we want to talk about. Things like collaboration, spoken word, going to gigs, podcasting, all these different things. But we want to hear your suggestions as well, because we're like, it's a penciled in list.
Yeah.
It's not in permanent ink yet. So we're open to suggestion and we want to know what you'd like to hear about. So reach out on the socials and tune in next week, I guess. Like and subscribe and all that business.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.